It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll dive into the history of the hybrid land-water vehicles known as the Ducks and how they became one of the longest-running attractions in the Wisconsin Dells.
But first, the state budget writing process remains stalled with key questions over transportation funding, the Milwaukee Bucks arena, and prevailing wage contributing to the holdup.
As lawmakers continue to debate, the delay gives lobbyists more of a chance to make the case for their agenda, with the hopes that some provisions will be added into the budget.
State government reporter Jason Stein has reported on that lobbying effort for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joins us now. Welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, how much longer do you think we'll expect the budget process to last here?
I don't know the answer to that question. I joke that I think I need psychics more than sources at this point to figure that out. We'll see. There's a meeting among Republican leaders this afternoon, so we'll see if there's any breakthroughs from that.
Is there any news or of progress on transportation or the Bucks Arena at this point?
Well, today there was actually, I don't know if you'd call it progress, there was a development. I think it makes things more complex, but a majority of the Republicans in the state assembly are saying that they don't want all the cuts in the transportation budget to hit outstate. They want southeastern Wisconsin, and by that they mean the zoo interchange, to feel some impact as well.
So they want to spread out the pain a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. So you guys are all about transportation today. You got the Ducks. You got transportation. I guess you got the Bucks too. So it's kind of an equal opportunity.
I guess so. Now another thing that you've been reporting on is a lobbying campaign of sorts related to Motion 999. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yep. This is that special time that only comes every 2 years for lobbyists to get something into state law that may be a tough sell at other times. And this is something you see when both parties are in charge. You get to the very end of the state budget process, and you typically have a night of, budget writing that'll go late, sometimes all the way to dawn of the next day. And there's a special motion called 999, and it typically is kind of a Christmas tree of goodies, and we'll get the thing, at midnight for the first time, and we'll look at it, and there'll be several things in it always that we say, what is this? Who is this designed to benefit?
But this is just part of the political process, huh?
That's it. That's the beauty of democracy right there in action. Go ahead.
Now, this has been a particularly challenging budget, though. I mean, do you think that there
right.
there may be fewer things that show up in this motion 999?
Well, that could work too. It could work two ways. It could work that way. It could work, given the cuts that some people are seeing, you're unlikely to see a lot of money being appropriated, like tax dollars being appropriated in that motion for people, because there's not a lot of tax money right now up for grabs. But you know, government can help people be winners or losers in lots of different ways. So there may be, a number of things in that motion that may be as good as money for an industry or a business or, some other recipient. In the past we've seen, for instance, bail bondsmen, also known as bounty hunters, got authorized to do business in Wisconsin in the 999 motion, only to have that provision vetoed twice by Governor Walker. But that's just one example.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state government reporter Jason Stein about this motion 999. What are some of the things that you think will show up on the Christmas tree this year, Jason?
Sure. Well, here's some things that we've been told by lawmakers and lobbyists and others that are being discussed. We'll see if they make the final cut. One would be changing the rules for rent-to-own stores in Wisconsin. So these are the outlets that do high-cost financing contracts for customers to, take a TV or a sofa or something like that home and pay it off over time. Right now in Wisconsin, they have to disclose to you, here's as an annual percentage rate, interest. This is the interest that you're paying on this product. The stores don't like that. They argue that they're different than a straight out loan because you can take the TV back. And so they've been trying for some time to get that law changed. And, you know, there's some discussion that may be one of the things that's in the budget.
And the main reason behind wanting to get that law changed is that they feel like it's unfair in some way.
Right. They feel like because you can take that TV back, they shouldn't have to disclose to you in terms of an interest rate how much you're really paying for that TV. You know, the other argument is that not all consumers are very sophisticated, and giving them that information helps them make a decision. One other thing I was going to say earlier is that, you know, because the budget is so tight, you can often, you know, you may need to get lawmakers on board for it, and you know, giving them a provision in this last motion can be one way to get them on board.
So it's possible that this time around we may see a lot of ornaments then.
Sometimes it's kind of paradoxical, but sometimes not having much money can be an incentive to add, you know, more new policies to the budget.
So we have the rent-to-own thing. What are some other things that you're hearing maybe put into the budget?
Right. One thing that we've heard is some changes in how chiropractors are paid that would be, increase payments by health insurers to chiropractors. Another one is it's kind of arcane, but it matters in the health insurance world is a changes in how these pharmacy benefit managers, you know, that you have with your health insurer to help you with drug buying or make it less costly, that would sort of change the way they interact with local pharmacists in a way that would be financially beneficial to the pharmacist. So there's a number of things like that are floating around the Capitol right now.
Now, is there a typical sort of character of the kind of things that wind up in budgets like this, or does it really vary depending on what year it is?
Well, again, you may have good policy, you may have bad policy go in at midnight in one of these motions, but it tends to be things that for one reason or another don't work so well in the light of day.
Now, are there a lot of people that are opposed to these things? Is it difficult to oppose something because basically it seems like you're being opposed to the budget?
Well, right. I mean, once something gets into the budget, it's very hard to get it out. You know, you have this committee vote, and then if you're a lawmaker and you're voting on the budget on the floor, very difficult to get individual items out of the budget until you sort of have to vote on it as a whole rather than on a small portion of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason. And again, oftentimes, if somebody has an idea that can stand on its own, it will stand on its own as a separate bill. You know, sometimes when these ideas get added at the end of the budget process without a public hearing on the idea, it's something that for one reason or another, people calculate that it can't stand on its own.
Now, the one way they could stop, though, is the governor. He has the final say on these line items, right? Do you think it's likely that he'd veto any of these as they get in there?
Well, he's done some of that in the past. Wisconsin governors really have their veto pin, their partial veto authority has been pared back a little bit, but it's really still one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, veto pins in the nation when it comes to budget bills. So he really has a lot of ability to remove some of these items. But, you know, obviously his administration will be lobbied by the same people that, succeed in getting some of these things in.
Well, this will be interesting to watch. Jason Stein, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the ducks.
Well, that'll be in just a few minutes. We're talking to Jason Stein, a state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the possible last-minute special interest additions to the state budget.
If you've ever been to the Wisconsin Dells, you may have taken a ride in an unusual vehicle that travels both on the land and in the water. The original Wisconsin Ducks have been shuttling folks around the Dells since the end of the Second World War, and they're celebrating their 70th season in operation this year.
But how did a seemingly oddball vehicle built for military use become one of the most popular attractions in the Dells? And most importantly, what's it like to actually get behind the wheel of one?
Well, joining us now to talk more about the Ducks is Dan Govinsky. He's the General Manager of Original Wisconsin Ducks and Dells Boat Tours. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the duck itself, the vehicle, kind of half boat, half truck. What's the story about how these things came to be?
They were built between 1942 and 1945 for use during World War II. They were used to carry troops and cargo from ships to shore, and in some cases they would carry troops and supplies even 50, 60 miles inland. And after the war, a gentleman had an idea to bring a duck to Wisconsin Dells, and his name was Melvin Flath. And he knew a guy who lived across the street from him who owned a duck by the name of Bob Unger, and they decided to bring it to Wisconsin Dells in the summer of 1946 to try it out. And they had great success with that one duck back in 46. So then after that season, Unger took his duck and drove it down to Florida. He was a young 23-year-old, just out of the service, so he could do whatever he wanted, and he took it out of the Dells. And after that, Flath, over the next few years, purchased 37 ducks because he had seen the success that Unger had had with that duck that first season.
I'm guessing the name duck is not the official name for these vehicles, especially if they're military vehicles, right?
The military gave it a term of DUKW. D was the year that they were manufactured, U stood for amphibian, K was front-wheel drive, and W was rear-wheel drive. And just because of the similar name, they started to be referred to as ducks, D-U-C-K-S.
And so these vehicles are basically war veterans, right?
I mean, Yes, they are. They're all the vehicles that we have were from World War II. The last ones, as I said, were manufactured in 1945.
Now, do you know what they? I mean, are you able to track what some of these ducks' histories are, or is that something that sticks with them?
The majority of the ducks that we have were kept in the United States at the bases. But we do have a few that we had purchased from Italy about 15 years ago, and a couple of those are in service, and those would have been used in the invasion of Sicily and then on to Italy after that.
Now, do they have, like, war wounds or anything like that, or do they just kind of look like the other ducks?
The ones we have were all in pretty good shape.
So you've got, as I understand it, one of the biggest fleets of ducks in the country. There are other places that do these duck tours, but Wisconsin has the largest fleet. How did you get so many?
Well, Flath started accumulating vehicles, and then through the years there was a ownership change a couple times, and the company kept growing, and we kept seeing a need for more and more vehicles. And our fleet now has 92 vehicles. Of the 92, we have 45 that are regular tour ducks. We have another 8 that shuttle people back and forth from our downtown area. And we have vehicles that are used as work vehicles. They still have the winches on them in case we would have any vehicle that would break down on the water or on the lake. Those work vehicles are used to bring the ducks to shore. Other vehicles are kept in storage for future use.
And so the thrill of the whole thing is you're able to drive people around on land and then take them into water and then go back on land again.
That is correct. The most amazing thing about it is you're driving down one of our scenic trails and all of a sudden you drive this land vehicle right into the water, and people are fascinated by it.
Now, I have not been on a duck myself. I've heard from other people on staff. One person described it as terrifying but fun. Another person, scary but fun. So
it's fun. I've been on it.
What is the thrill factor here on these things? Is it like a roller coaster kind of?
No, it's a scenic thrill ride. It's an 8.5-mile tour of the Wisconsin River, Lake Dalton. And then we have about 4.5 miles of scenic trails that go along the river. The property has all been maintained in its scenic state without any buildings or any development on the property. And the duck travels through fern-filled canyons and gets up close through the sandstone formations along the river and on land through the gorges.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking to Dan Gavinsky. He's the manager, the general manager of Original Wisconsin Ducks and Dell's Boat Tours. We're talking about the 70th anniversary of the ducks in Wisconsin Dells. And here's a question I have for you, Dan. What's it like driving one of these things? Is it like, you know, taking a Vega out for a spin, or what's it like? I mean, is it a hard thing to drive?
Well, we have a 2 to 6 week training program to teach our drivers how to drive them. They have manual transmissions, and which involves double clutching, and so it takes a little while to teach our people how to drive. But it's
do they have diesel engines on them?
Yeah, we've gone through a conversion in the last few years from gas to diesel engines.
Dan, how fast do they go?
On land, they go about 6 to 7 miles an hour, or on the water, they go 6 to 7 miles an hour, and then on land, they can get up to 50 miles per hour.
Now, do they still make, the ones that you use were made in the 40s, but why didn't they make more of them? It seems like there would be a market for that.
Well, it's a military vehicle, and they kept them in service through about 1958, and then after that, you know, they came up with other concepts to use for amphibious purposes, but it was one of the most important vehicles during World War II. Over 2,000 ducks were involved on D-Day with the invasion in France.
Now, obviously, this is something that has caught on, particularly in the Dells. People have been loving this for 70 years now. How do people react the first time that they take a duck ride?
Well, it's a great experience for them, the young children that are taking it. It's the big wow factor when the duck drives into the water. And we've had generation after generation of families that are taking the tour. Grandparents are bringing their grandchildren because it was something that they had done a long time ago. And it's part of the experience of being in Wisconsin Dells. And it's such an iconic Midwestern attraction that started here in Wisconsin Dells. Now, there are other duck companies that have started up around the country, but in some of those cases, they are not. They have a vehicle that is remanufactured to look like a duck, and they're not original World War II vehicles.
So is there something special about taking out the original World War II vehicles for you? Is that something that's important to you?
Yeah, we've tried to maintain that, and it gives the people the opportunity to actually ride in one and drive down the water just like it was done over 70 years ago. And the fact that it is a military vehicle and that is now being used for commercial purposes, you know, I think is pretty unique.
And is there also something special about the landscape of the Dells so that when people are in one of these, the duck is the perfect vehicle to see the landscape in?
It certainly is. Wisconsin Dells is known for the beautiful sandstone rock formations along the upper Dells and the lower Dells, and most of the property has been preserved in its natural state. And the duck is the most unique way of seeing this beautiful piece of property, both on the water and on the land.
Now, have there ever been times when the ducks have been called into duty for emergencies or anything like that? Because it seems like they'd be useful in floods and things like that.
Yeah, through the years, the ducks have been called over to Baraboo several times, and then back in 2008 when we had all that rain and the lake drained, the ducks were being used to move piers and rafts and trees that were floating over towards the dam to clear the spillway off, and then we were also out on the water trying to catch boats that had been floating away. And then also that following week, when the rains continued, the ducks were taking federal and state officials on Interstate 90 when it was closed because of all the flooding that was taking place, and the ducks were being used to observe the flooding and see what was happening and what could be done to try and get the interstate open.
Wow.
Now, Nathan on Facebook left us a comment. He said, I remember doing this once as a kid. The driver's favorite phrase was 10 miles per hour on water, 20 on land, and 60 straight off a cliff. A little duck driver humor there, I guess. Do you have to have something special, some humor to be one of these folks?
Oh, it's part of the driver is the pilot and the guide, and they do a narration and talking about the geology, the history, and they provide humor to it through the jokes that they have. And in some of the places, you pull up on top of a sandstone bluff overlooking the Wisconsin River, and then you go down a steep hill after that, and that's when they start telling those stories like that. And it's a joke, and the people that have ridden it are expecting it, but the jokes still go over very well.
Now, you started working for the organization when you were a kid, right?
Yeah, I was fortunate to be able to get a job when I was 14 years old, working in the parking lot, cleaning up the grounds, cleaning the bathrooms, and did that until I was 18 and able to get a license to drive a vehicle. Drove it through college, and it's one of the premier college jobs here in Wisconsin Dells for the kids that drive them. It's a great opportunity to work outside, work driving a unique vehicle, be on the water, and you're able to entertain hundreds of people every day.
Thanks so much. Dan Gravinsky, sorry. And who is he again, Veronica?
Well, Dan Gravinsky, general manager of the original Wisconsin Ducks and Dells Boat Tours. He joined us to talk about the history of the Wisconsin Ducks as they celebrate their 70th season in the Dell.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's been a lot of attention in recent years to the partisan divide in Wisconsin politics. From the Act 10 budget bill through protests, recalls, and on to the current debates over university and education funding in the state's budget proposal.
Our next guest has been exploring that divide, and she says a big part of that conflict comes from a distrust of Madison in the state's small towns and rural communities. She says there's a sense that those parts of the state can be ignored in budgets and marginalized in other important decisions, which can lead to feelings of resentment that play out at election time.
Kathy Kramer joins us here in the studio. She's written papers on the topic and is exploring wider issues of the political divide in a forthcoming book. She's interim director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service and professor of political science at UW-Madison. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should say you're director now, is that correct?
Oh, that's correct. Yes, I'm very honored to be director of the Morgridge Center, you bet.
Well, Kathy, as part of your research, you get together with small groups of people and communities around the state, talk about politics and other issues. When people in small towns and rural areas talk about state politics, what kind of themes come out consistently?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety, like there is for a lot of people in the state, but one thing that I've heard very strongly was this sense of rural areas feeling as though their resources are being taxed away and pulled to Madison and spent on Madison and Milwaukee, and that they're not getting their fair share in return. And there's also this sense that they don't get enough say in the political power or the decision-making of the state, and also a general sense that they're misunderstood, that people in the cities just don't get what rural life is like.
Now, when we're talking about the cities, is it in general Madison and Milwaukee, or is it usually Madison?
Madison and Milwaukee, but Madison gets a special focus because the state government is located here, and so it really is. Both of the cities are seen as power centers in the state, but I think because the state capital is here and the flagship school of the university system is here, that there's a lot of focus on Madison and that kind of resentment.
So how does that play out when we're looking at big revenue issues, things like the state budget? How does that tend to get processed in small town Wisconsin in terms of thinking or feeling that it might not be getting its fair due?
Well, there's a question about, you know, there's a sense that my taxes are going up, but life in our town is not necessarily improving. The job prospects aren't necessarily improving, and our schools are, you know, kind of strapped, and we're having a hard time making ends meet. So however revenue is being spent doesn't seem to be benefiting our community. So why would we advocate raising taxes to spend more of our money that clearly isn't benefiting us? So you can see that pattern of thinking promotes a lot of resistance to more government spending.
So that's the pattern of thinking. Does your research get into whether or not there is, in fact, some reality there that some rural communities and parts of the state do get marginalized?
Well, yeah, I do try to investigate that a bit, and it's not necessarily the case that smaller communities in the state are on the short end of the stick when it comes to how public resources are divided up. It depends on the policy area, and it depends on the level of government. So in some cases, yes, but in other cases, it tends to be that rural communities get more public funding per capita than urban communities. So it's the resentment is real, whether the data actually support the idea that rural areas aren't getting their fair share is very debatable.
Now, you've put this down, at least in part, to divisive politics. Politics in Wisconsin are very divided right now. How would you characterize the way we think about politics in the state?
Well, I would say it's painful. I mean, right now, it's politics in the state of Wisconsin are a very painful topic, and I think we've probably felt that the most at the time of the recall election, the gubernatorial recall election, when there were many stories and many personal stories and stories through the news about how people were having a difficult time talking with one another about politics. What those divides actually are, my interest is more in how they're influencing the way we talk with one another and the way we relate to one another. And they're real. I mean, they're real in the sense of in our workplaces, but probably even more so outside of the workplace, in our families, how difficult it is to sometimes have conversations across people who are public employees and private employees. That's where I've seen it and heard the stories of the most. So generally, I would say our politics are painful.
So when you got these political divides that come up when we talk about politics, do you have a sense about whether, when there's resentment, that it's directed at people or a group of people, or is it directed at a policy?
People, which I think is what makes it so problematic, that right now our politics are so personal that the targets of blame have become individual people, whether it be public employees or public school teachers or Democrats versus Republicans, or those people in the cities, or those people in rural areas who just don't understand how hard we actually work, right? Something we hear in Madison. It's less about policies and more about resentment towards actual groups of people.
Do you see that being a kind of a two-way street, that people from the cities, public employees, funnel that resentment back at maybe people in rural areas?
I think it's definitely a two-way street, if not a multiple-way street, that there's this, I think, in a time of uncertainty in which we have right now, economic uncertainty and otherwise, there's just a lot of distrust has been bred, and people of a variety of backgrounds are feeling that. And once you have a culture in which there's so much divisiveness and distrust, it's people kind of hunker down and exude their own, sense of blame. And that it's a cycle that perpetuates itself. So once, a next question is, how the heck do we get out of that? And that's a key question for me. As someone who grew up here, I just find it very, very sad and very difficult. And I try to imagine ways of kind of reversing the trend and making it possible for people to see one another as Wisconsinites again.
We're talking right now with Kathy Kramer from UW-Madison. She's director of the Mortgage Center for Public Service and a professor of political science at UW-Madison. And Kathy, do you see Wisconsin as a special case, or are we seeing divided politics across the country, or is there something especially difficult about Wisconsin politics right now?
I think there's divisiveness across the country for sure, but in my mind it's a special case in that Wisconsin was seen as a place of civility and clean government for a long time, and the reversal in the level of trust toward government and the level of trust toward one another seems to have been pretty quick in my mind. So it's a special case in that I think here more than many other places, there's a sense that something has been lost or something has changed rapidly.
Well, I want to get to some of those brainstorming of solutions that you were talking about. But first, I want to talk a little bit especially about the UW system, because you've also zeroed in to look at how people outside of Madison look at UW-Madison. What did you find, and how did you conduct that?
Well, I was going to say it's tricky. It's not tricky, but it's complicated, so I want to be careful about how I convey it, because on the one hand, I found that people love the University of Wisconsin system and have so much pride in their local state school or college and the University of Wisconsin-Madison itself. And yet, I've encountered a lot of criticism, even though people knew that I was very proud to be a faculty member here and that I was indeed a professor of political science. People still had plenty to say that was critical of faculty members, for example, such as this perception that we're lazy and we never teach our own courses and that we're elitist in the sense of making a lot of money for not working very hard or being out of touch with small town Wisconsin life. So there was criticism along those lines. And yet there was definitely this sense of ownership of University of Wisconsin-Madison and the system as a whole, and taking pride in the fact that Wisconsin has this extensive higher education public system. And, you know, Badger fandom, Badger sports are everywhere.
Right. People brought up
state.
Sports a lot when you said, what does the UW-Madison do right? They said sports.
Yeah. And sometimes people laugh when I say that, but I think it's really important that many people in the state have a connection to UW-Madison in particular because they are rabid Badger fans. And I think that's a very positive thing for many people who have not gone to school here or don't have a family member here. They have this strong emotional tie to this school. So I think people want to be more a part of UW-Madison, and yet they also feel strongly a part of it already.
Well, as you know, the UW system has been in the news a lot recently, both because of the proposed $300 million budget cut over 2 years that's been reduced now in the Joint Finance Committee, and a proposal to strike tenure language from state law, those being a couple of hot-button issues around the UW-Madison. How are those issues going over in rural Wisconsin?
Well, I have not had the opportunity to go back around to all of these communities to ask people what they're thinking about the proposed budget cuts. So I really don't know for sure, but just thinking back on the conversations that I have had with people, I think there would probably be a mix of, you know, we're all hurting, we all have to cut back, cuts are necessary, and also a sense, well, is it going to be even harder for my child to attend school there, or is it going to be more difficult for my kid to get in? So I imagine there'd be a mix of reactions to it.
We're talking right now with Kathy Kramer from UW-Madison about one of the divisions in Wisconsin politics, a feeling among people in rural parts of the state and small towns that they're overlooked, ignored, maybe underfunded by the government in Madison.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this political divide between the state's capital and its small towns? If you live in a small town or a rural area, do you feel this? Do you think your needs and those of your community don't get the attention they deserve? Or do you see any ways to bridge the gap between urban and rural Wisconsin in our politics? Or maybe you're from a suburban area and you're kind of in the middle on the whole thing. We'd like to hear from you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with UW-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer, looking at Wisconsin's divided politics and her research into the division, even the resentment between small-town Wisconsin and the state capital and larger cities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel a sense that there are haves and have-nots when it comes to state policies, budgeting, and decision-making? Do you think your community, your small town, or big city, or in between does maybe get the short end of the stick? Do you see resentment, divisive politics playing a big role in state politics? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We've got Bob on the line in Kenosha. Hi, Bob.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd make a comment. Live in Southeastern, and I've always voted Democrat. Own property in very northern Wisconsin, and find it very interesting to go to the grocery store or anywhere, hardware store, and listen to the conversation and just kind of keep my mouth shut listening to the people making comments, and most of them are flying stickers or bumper stickers that are Sportsman for Walker, and how when you talk about the Capitol, and that's what comes to mind, that he's promoting small town USA, and I kind of just happen to think the opposite, that these people are being not truthful of themselves and think that primarily they're last on anybody's list there. But that's just my opinion. I don't know what your take is on that.
All right, Bob, thank you for that call. Appreciate your thoughts there. And Bob, you know, there are dichotomies within small towns too.
Thanks, Bob, for calling in. I hear what you're saying, and I, I'm fumbling here because I think what you're saying is that, and this is a concern I hear often, that, you know, it seems that people in small town Wisconsin who support Governor Walker are not, they're not recognize their interests appropriately. And I think it's kind of a myth that people have interests that we as someone outside their own lives can identify. I mean, what I try to tell myself as a public opinion scholar is I don't know what people's interests are, because that's something that they define for themselves through their experience and the way they perceive the world. And so in that situation, like in the grocery stores in northern Wisconsin, say you're in a tourist community, you know, how does it feel to be somebody living in that town, really struggling to make ends meet, and seeing the tourists come in primarily from cities downstate, right, buying really expensive champagne and food during their vacation time? And I think if what they're perceiving is that Scott Walker is someone who understands small town people like them, then they are perceiving that it is in their interest to vote for him and support him. So I guess what I'm saying is it's all in the eye of the beholder. And I appreciate your concern that you could go to these communities and wonder, you know, I'm not really sure that the Republican Party is supporting people in this town. And yet, if we spend time there and recognize their experiences and their perception that, you know, the wealth is in the cities and not here, that their desire to cut back on government makes sense. I'm not saying that it's necessarily, you know, the right stance, but it's a little more understandable when we do the thing like you're doing, just listening to what people are saying and try to understand where they're coming from.
Thank you for that call. We're talking with Kathy Kramer, director of the Mortgage Center for Public Service at UW-Madison. And you can join us at 800-642-1234 as we talk about a perceived urban-rural divide in Wisconsin. That's 800-642-1234. And we go next to Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Yes, it is my perception that rural communities in Wisconsin really have a much more hearty work ethic and feel taken advantage of by people who are dependent on the state. And whereas in urban environments, you have a much higher concentration of people who are dependent on government subsidies of one form or another. And the association with that makes it more acceptable, because if your friends are, you know, on the dole, then, well, it must be okay because they're your friends. You don't want to criticize your friends. And then they feel, you know, taken advantage of and misunderstood.
Thank you so much for your thoughts, Chris. Appreciate your call. And Kathy, this echoes very closely what you hear in terms of this divide, looking at who gets public benefits, whether they're worthy of the benefits, and whose tax dollars go to support whom. How does that symbolize to you what you're hearing in Wisconsin right now?
That is a very familiar sentiment that I hear. One of the things I liked to do while I was traveling around the state is to take statements like that and share them with some of the rural, or I'm sorry, some of the urban and suburban groups I spent time with. And I said, you know, here's what I'm hearing in rural Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, to a group of people meeting in Milwaukee. And, you know, what do you think of that? And sometimes their response back to me would be, you know, kind of chuckling and saying, you know, have they been to Milwaukee? Have they seen the way we work, or the fact that we, too, are working three jobs to make ends meet? So that's one thing I would say in response. And another is government subsidies come in so many forms. And I think oftentimes when we talk about government subsidies, we think about kind of traditional welfare benefits. But, you know, all of us who own a home and get a mortgage tax deduction are getting a government subsidy. All of us who drive on roads are getting a government subsidy. And I think a lot of the government subsidies to the cities are very visible in the news, but a lot of the government subsidies in other parts of the state are very real, but we don't as often draw attention to them.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, Kathy, what possible solutions do you have in mind to moving toward a shared identity as Wisconsinites?
Public radio. I was not paid to say that. But I think any opportunity we have to talk with one another for real and listen to other points of view is just enormously valuable, because I think one of the greatest losses we've had in this state is dialogue and civility and this idea that we are supposed to be in this together. Suddenly, there's a very palpable sense that we are not in this together, and we are on opposite sides, and the other point of view can't possibly be worth listening to. So I think we should expect it from our leaders, and our leaders should do it, but we should also do it in our own everyday life, too.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Kathy Kramer, director of the Mortgage Center for Public Service and professor of political science at UW-Madison.
This weekend marked a very special day, a day that changed the way we feel about swimming, summer blockbusters, and the power of music to terrify us. This Saturday, June 20th, was the 40th anniversary of the movie Jaws.
Jaws put the name Steven Spielberg on the map, and it also helped cement the movie soundtrack fame of composer John Williams. Who knew two notes repeated over and over could be so scary?
Scary.
Shark biologists say the movie was not so great for shark-human relations and shark conservation, and author Peter Benchley has tried to correct for that over the years. Honestly, I'm not sure it's working for me. I feel for shark conservation, but I'm still really scared of sharks thanks to this movie.
But think of all the weird influences that Jaws had on... We wouldn't have Shark Week if
it
wasn't for Jaws,
I
right?
I love Shark Week.
We wouldn't have the land shark on Saturday Night Live if it wasn't for Jaws. So it's actually had quite an influence on our lives, whether we like it or not.
Well, happy birthday to Jaws.